Chapter 81. Lowry started out by apologizing for the extreme lateness of his warning, and then he said he had just heard from an MP friend at Fort Benning in Georgia, where the 75th Ranger Regiment was based. Apparently, a lieutenant colonel from their remote detachment at Kelham had phoned home and told his bosses there were still two CID majors on the scene locally, one on the post itself and one in town, the latter a prize pain in the ass. And because his bosses were determined that Senator Riley be shown nothing but a good time, they had dispatched a babysitting squad to muzzle the said CID majors for the remaining duration of the senator's visit, just in case. Lowry said the squad had left Benning in a Black Hawk helicopter some time ago, and therefore might well have already arrived at Kelham. MPs? I said. They won't mess with me. Not MPs, Lowry said. Regular Rangers. Real tough guys. How many?
Six,
Lowry said. Three for you and three for Monroe, I guess. Rules of engagement?
I don't know. What does it take to muzzle you?
More than three Rangers, I said. I scanned the street out the window and saw nothing moving. No vehicles, no pedestrians. I said, don't worry about me, Stan. It's Monroe I'm concerned about. I need two pairs of hands tonight. It's going to make it harder if he gets hung up.
Which he will, Lowry said. You will too, probably. Word is, these guys aren't kidding around.
Would you call him for me and give him the same warning? I asked. If they haven't already gotten to him, that is. I recited Monroe's VOQ number, and I heard the scratch of a pencil as Lowry wrote it down. Then I asked, has your pet banker come through on Alice Booten yet?
Negative, Lowry said. He's been busy all day. But Nagley is still on it.
Call her and tell her to take a thumb out of her ass and get me some results. Tell her if I'm busy with the G.I. Joes when she calls, she's authorized to leave a message with the waitress.
Okay, and good luck, Lowry said, and hung up.
I stepped out to the sidewalk and looked up and down the street. Nothing doing. I guessed the Rangers would look for me first in one of the bars. Probably Brannan's. If I was planning to make trouble, that was where I would be. So I looped around through the dogleg alley and scanned the acre of ground from deep in the shadows. And sure enough, there was a Humvee parked right there, big and green and obvious. I guessed the plan was to frog march me over to it and throw me in the back and drive me out to Kelham, and then to stash me in whatever room Monroe was already locked up in. Then the plan would be to wait until the senator's Lear left at midnight and let us out again, and apologize most sincerely for the misunderstanding. Everyone has a plan, until they get punched in the mouth. I eased out around the corner of Brannan's bar and looked in through the window. The place was sparkling clean. Tables and chairs were neatly arrayed, all around the focal point I assumed would be occupied by the senator and his son. Acolytes would sit close by, and there was plenty of open space where the less well-connected could stand. Jonathan and Hunter Brannan were behind the bar, looking well-rested and well-nourished after their early dinner. Three guys in BDUs were talking to them. They were Rangers, each of them a decent size, and none of them a rookie. One of them was a sergeant, and two of them were specialists. Their uniforms had seen plenty of wear, and their boots were clean but creased. Their faces were tanned and lined and blank. They were professional soldiers, pure and simple, which was a dumb expression because professional soldiers were all kinds of things, none of which was pure and none of which was simple. But ultimately, it didn't matter exactly what two of them were, because the sergeant was in charge. And I had never met a sergeant who was less than well aware that there were 18 ranks above him in the hierarchy, all the way up to the commander-in-chief, and that they all made more money than he did in exchange
for making policy decisions. In other words, whatever a sergeant did, there were 18 groups of people ready, willing, and waiting to criticize him. I eased back into the shadows and headed back to the diner. There were 3 customers still in the place, including the old couple from Toussaint's and the guy in the pale suit I had seen once before. 3 was a good number, but not a great number. On the other hand, the demographics were close to perfect. Local business people, solid citizens, mature, easily outraged. And the old couple, at least, were guaranteed to stay for hours, which was good, because I might need hours, depending on Nagley's progress or the lack of it. I came in the door and stopped by the phone, and the waitress shook her head at me to tell me there had been no incoming calls. I used the phone book and found the number for Brannan's bar, and then I put a quarter in the slot and dialed. One of the Brannan brothers answered, and I said, "Let me speak to the sergeant." I heard a second of surprise and uncertainty, and then I heard the phone being reversed on the bar, and I heard the click of nails and the thump of palms as the receiver was passed from hand to hand, and then a voice said, "Who is this?" I said, "This is the guy you're looking for. I'm in the diner." No answer. I said, "This is the part where you want to put your hand over the mouthpiece long enough to ask the barman where the diner is, so you can send your guys to check while you keep me talking on the phone. But I'll save you the trouble. The diner is about 20 yards west of you and about 50 yards north. Send one guy through the alley on your left, and the other counterclockwise out of the lot and around the sheriff's department building. You personally can come in through the kitchen door, which should be pretty close to where you parked your truck. That way, you've got me covered in every direction. But don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. I'll wait for you, right here. You'll find me at a table in back." Then I hung up and walked to the rearmost table for 4.